This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, a look at the legacy of President Gerald Ford and Iraq prepares for the execution of Saddam Hussein. We're joined by Julianne Malveaux, economist and author, also president and CEO of Last Word Productions, and Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators. He's also the former deputy assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney. They're both in Washington, D.C. And in New York, we've got Walter Fields, political consultant. Thanks to all of you for being with us, and let's talk about Gerald Ford, 38th president of the United States. He was the oldest living president, one of the few unelected presidents in American history, not elected as president, not elected as vice president, and he took office when President Nixon resigned following Watergate. So his record on civil rights appears to be mixed. He voted for the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the 65 Voting Rights Act, but as a congressman, he opposed school busing, public housing, and the minimum wage. He ran for president in 76, but lost to Jimmy Carter, who got 90% of the black vote. Now, Ron, in tributes to Ford over the past couple days, we've heard a lot about how he helped turn the nation around following Watergate and during Vietnam. So we haven't heard much about his legacy with race. How do you think he did when he was president?
Well, I think Gerald Ford came in the country in a very difficult time. Clearly, he came at a point where America needed a healer and America needed a consensus builder, and I think they got both in Gerald Ford. At the same time, however, if you look at some of the urban problems that we had in the United States, if you look at the high energy prices at that period of time, and also at the unemployment rate, I think Gerald Ford helped bring about policies that brought energy prices down lower, that helped bring about employment in areas that needed that employment the most, and helped try to heal the country and bring it together as a consensus builder. So I think that his record on civil rights during his presidency is one that's best viewed in economic terms and employment terms, and I think he did a pretty good job of it.
Julianne, what do you think?
Basically, Ron's correct. I do think that he was the accidental president for 2 years, so he really didn't have very much chance to make that much of a difference. When he came in, the misery index, which is defined as the sum of the unemployment rate and inflation, was at 20%, which the unemployment rate was like 9.3 and inflation was at 11%. Of course, he had this inane policy of wearing these tags on your lapel, whip inflation now or when, which did a lot of good. But I think by and large, his job was to keep the country calm. Now, he did do a couple of things that he should get credit for. William Coleman was only the second African-American cabinet member. He was appointed under Gerald Ford. Jesse Owens was also given the Medal of Freedom under Jerry Ford. And I think that the third thing that's worth noting is that after his presidency, he joined with the University of Michigan in supporting affirmative action policies. He's on record with a letter there. At the same time, I mean, Earl Butz was his Secretary of Agriculture. We need not reprise that unfortunate set of jokes about what black people like. And I don't think he was ever very aggressive about issues. He was basically, Farai, in preparation for talking about him, I called some people who knew him back in Grand Rapids. And the words that comes out most about him is he's a decent guy. African-American people in Grand Rapids, you know, have love for him. They think highly of him. They're proud that he came from Grand Rapids. And as a president, he wasn't exceptional on civil rights. But then in that era, frankly, who was?
Walter, he was someone who Julianne just called an accidental president. He certainly stepped into a country that was just completely torn, ripped apart by Watergate. What can you expect from anyone at a time like that? Did he help heal the nation?
Well, I think he most definitely did. You know, Gerald Ford had an interesting career because he was placed into positions of prominence twice by accident. Once after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, when he was appointed to the Warren Commission, and that was a very controversial commission investigating the assassination of President Kennedy. And then, of course, when he assumed the presidency. And I think his legacy, for the most part, will be viewed through the prism of the Constitution and the fact that this is a man who stepped in at one of the most difficult moments in this nation's history, when, if you recall that period as I do, it was a time when people were questioning whether or not the United States government would continue to function. There were some real questions about our democracy at that time because so many people had lost faith. We had a vice president who resigned, and then we had a president that resigned. And even the international community was questioning the legitimacy of the United States government. Gerald Ford stepped in that moment and showed that our Constitution does work in terms of keeping the government going. And I think that's going to be his legacy. He was president for only 2 years, so there was not much that he could do as president. But in a much larger sense, in many ways, Gerald Ford saved our nation and our democracy when he stepped in as president.
I'm going to stay with you and go to a very different president, Saddam Hussein, former president of Iraq. An appeals court has upheld an earlier decision to execute him. It's going to be within the next 30 days. It's argued that Iraq's president has to be speedily executed. And also, there's been a report that a website posted a letter that Saddam wrote in November saying that the Iraqi people should not hate the United States. At this point, we're entering a holy period in Islam. There's a festival following the Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. And now you've got this execution order. There's already so much trouble in Iraq. What can we expect?
I think it's hard to predict what we can expect. I mean, I'm certainly sure that Saddam Hussein will be executed. What I'm really concerned over, though, is the process. You know, the notion of crimes against humanity seems to be sort of a selective prosecution in the international community, because there are many leaders who could certainly be brought to charges for crimes against humanity. And I think because the United States played such a heavy hand in this process, even though it was tried in an Iraqi court, the U.S. imprint is all over this process. I'm troubled by the fact that you're going to have this speedy execution of someone when we haven't really delved into all of the problems that affected that region. And Saddam certainly did not cause all of them by himself, even though we know that he was a dictator. So I think that it's hard to predict what the reaction is going to be in Iraq. I suspect that there will probably be some intermittent violence once he is executed. But I think the larger question continues to be, who is going to really govern this nation, and will they have self-determination? And I'm not sure that we will ever see that, or whether the United States will ever be able to cause that to happen.
Ron, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, is this good or bad for the United States that this execution is coming up? I mean, I think the Iraqi people will decide for themselves what it means to them. But for us, constantly as a nation battling the insurgencies there, what is it going to cause for the United States troops?
Well, I think first and foremost, this is a good ending of a chapter for the Iraqi people, that a brutal dictator, one who terrorized his own people, one who killed people using weapons of chemical weapons of destruction against the Kurds. He killed Sunnis. He killed Shiites. He killed his own people. Now, I agree with Walter that there's a heavy United States imprint over the court proceedings that surrounded Saddam Hussein's time in the courtroom and his time in the criminal justice system. My concern is, what will this do, as you pointed out a second ago, what will this do to our men and women who are on the ground? Iraq right now is really troubled by sectarian violence. Saddam Hussein is a Sunni. Saddam Hussein and the Sunni minority are very upset by the United States occupation. Will this lead to a flare-up of sectarian violence in Baghdad? Will it lead to a flare-up of sectarian violence into Crete and other Sunni strongholds that will put our men and women on the ground in greater risk? That, in the short term, is what I'm very concerned about. But am I sorry to see Saddam Hussein go, this brutal dictator? Absolutely not. He's going to have his day in the executioner's chair.
Julianne, very few countries that are considered among the most sophisticated in the world actually have the death penalty. The U.S. is one of those nations. And is this a reflection, this death penalty in Iraq, of means that could be outdated in a modern human era?
I think that the means is outdated. Certainly Saddam Hussein deserves punishment, but I'm concerned, as Walter is and many other people are, about the fact that he was only tried on one of what could be thousands of incidents. He was tried on the deaths of 148 Shiite men. There are so many other things that happen that we don't know about. I mean, the United States, there are some presidents of the United States, I believe, that will be breathing a sigh of relief if this man is executed, because we have been complicit with him in the past, frankly, and that's something we don't want to talk about. But Human Rights Watch and others who condemn Saddam Hussein for his brutality, and certainly the world must, have also said the death penalty should not be applied. I think the value in keeping Saddam Hussein alive is that there should be other investigations. There's other stuff that happened that we should know about. I also think that you don't meet brutality with brutality. I'm opposed to the death penalty here in the United States, and I'm opposed to it, you know, in the rest of the world. The letter that he put on the internet for Rai is quite interesting because it doesn't sound like the Hussein that we've all come to know and disparage at all. One wonders if he actually put it there, or someone else put it there, or what's going on. But it certainly does raise questions about how he'll be viewed in history. And I think the possibility of increased insurgency if he is put to death is something we have to be concerned about.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to NPR's News and Notes, and I'm Farai Chidea. We were just hearing from economist and author Julianne Melveaux, the president and CEO of Last Word Productions. We've also got Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators, and former deputy assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney, and political consultant Walter Fields. Want to move on to New Orleans, something we're going to be talking a lot about in later parts of the show, recapping some of our visits there. So next month, federal investigators are going to release findings regarding the more than $12 billion the U.S. government has awarded in Hurricane Katrina contracts. Investigators are said to have found rampant political favoritism, really unknown in Louisiana. They may have limited the amount of contracts awarded to small and minority-owned firms. It's estimated that the government may also have awarded more than $1 billion in fraudulent disaster aid following the 2005 storm. Now, Julianne, I know that you care a lot about the region, about New Orleans and Louisiana. What is all of this investigation of fraud doing to the overall need to really pay attention to Louisiana and New Orleans and the Gulf states?
Well, I think it's easy for us to get diverted by conversation about fraud and forget about the fact that they still don't have running water in parts of the Lower Ninth, Farai. John Edwards is down there today announcing that he's running for president and using the Lower Ninth as his backdrop. Kathleen Blanco, the governor, I mean, I could just, never mind, we're on the radio. But I mean, billions of dollars have gone for this road home program where people are supposed to be able to get up to $145,000 to rebuild or restart. As of about 3 weeks ago, less than 100, do you hear me? Less than 100 of these grants had been given when 67,000 people had applied for them. So we look at fraud and we think, oh, well, they're all stealing. Well, the fact is that there's stealing, there's bureaucracy, and there's drama. And all those things are combined. The political favoritism, unfortunately, has been largely Republican favoritism. The same companies who are making a whole bunch of money in Iraq are making a whole bunch of money from New Orleans. And companies like Halliburton and others, and I hate to call Halliburton out, but then again, Ron, I don't.
of course you don't.
But, you know, but some of these companies really need to have some form of a federal audit. I mean, they're making, you know, 50, 100% profit on providing meals that don't exist and removing waste that doesn't exist. And again, the impact of some of this on some of our relations, Farai, has been monumental. As we look at the immigrant community, for example, so many Mexican and Latino Americans, people who've come to clean waste, and the competition that many African Americans have raised, they're taking our jobs. Well, they're taking jobs where they're being paid little. A company like Halliburton bills out $60 an hour for waste removal, but pays the Latino at the end of the line $8. And the question is, who got the $52, not, you know, who took whose job? And those are the kinds of things that we're looking at some of the questions.
Let me let Ron get into this. Now, you worked for Vice President Dick Cheney, who used to be an executive at Halliburton. And Halliburton has gotten no-bid contracts in Iraq. And I'm not sure about what has happened in Louisiana, but
they
certainly
got
it's
some.
One of
they
the
got bi- some.
One of the big service providers there. Should there be more of a scrutiny? I mean, if the government is supposed to be really mindful of how it's spending money, should there be more scrutiny of how we dole out these contracts?
Absolutely. One of the things that Julianne and I will agree with is that I think it is disgusting that there are corporations or entities around the United States who would go to Louisiana, who would go to the Gulf region and exploit the tragedy of the people who are on the ground there, those whose homes have been devastated, those who don't have a roof over their head or don't have running water, for making a profit. I think the government, however, the federal government, is in a very difficult position. When there is a crisis where you need immediate response, the federal government is not your best answer. Your best answer is your state and your municipal entities, those who understand the needs of the local community, where the triage center should be, where the first responders and those who really need to get to those citizens in those vitally needed areas should respond to. At the same time, when the federal government spends your money, when they spend Walter's money, Julianne's money, my money, there needs to be an accounting to ensure that our tax dollars are being spent effectively and efficiently, and that those who would seek to corrupt or those who would seek to enrich their own pockets at the expense of those others, they should be fully investigated and brought to the fullest extent of the law.
Walter, what needs to happen to really help people on the ground? You know, this show has been to New Orleans many times, and there are people who, you know, really are just homesteading out in the city, living kind of like you would out in the middle of the woods with no running water, no electricity, but determined to stay in the city. But there's a lot of people who've just given up and they're saying, you know, I love New Orleans, but I can't come back. What needs to happen now?
Well, I have to disagree with Ron. The federal government is the only level of government that has the resources to respond to an emergency the magnitude of Katrina or September 11th. Those emergencies require incredible infusions of resources, and no state or local government has those resources available. The federal government can command those resources.
Let Walter finish, and then Ron, you can go.
I understand the issue of responding to, but the issue of who can bring in the resources, I think that becomes a federal government responsibility. In terms of the failure, I think the real failure is the 109th Congress, because the issue of accountability was off the table. This Congress failed in both Iraq and the situation with Katrina in terms of the awarding contracts to fulfill their oversight responsibility. I think what we've got to do is find out immediately what the most urgent needs are of people on the Gulf Coast, whether it's electricity, whether it's water or homes, and we've got to fix those immediately because there's some basic day-to-day needs that have gone unaddressed.
All right,
that's what we have to do in the short term.
30 seconds for Ron.
I agree with you, Walter. My point here, and I agree with you as it relates to oversight, my point is the federal government has the resources to go in and assist those who need the most vital assistance. What I'm saying, however, before that disaster, it is no surprise for anyone living in the state of Louisiana and Mississippi and the Gulf Coast that a big hurricane was going to come. I'm saying that our state and our local officials should have had better plans in place and should have been able to ask the federal government in advance of this terrible catastrophe coming to make sure that these resources that were vitally needed were in place. I think there was a breakdown at all levels of government, but I'm particularly concerned with what happened in the state of Louisiana government and in the city of New Orleans these regional areas in the Gulf Coast.
All right, we'll keep covering the Gulf Coast. That was Ron Christie, Vice President of the lobbying firm DC Navigators, Walter Fields, political consultant and economist and author Julianne Malveaux, President and CEO of Last Word Productions. Thank you all.
Thank you.